Very special guest joins us. Of course, played NCAA basketball at Hawaii. Then spent some time NBA training camps in the NBA Development League. Then spent many years in Europe and played the final few years, still playing in Canada. And just released a book, Chasing a Dream, The Carl English Story. Carl English joins us. Carl, welcome to the show. How you doing?
I'm great, boss. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I really appreciate it. And I want to focus on your book first, and then I got some basketball questions to get to. But your book is really amazing simply because it starts in a fashion that very few of us can relate to. You were 5 years of age when you lost both your parents. Just talk about what you remember of that and really how it impacted your life moving forward.
Well, I guess, I mean, it's a long time now, but I went into depth with the book. I think I was first approached to do a book in, I want to say 2000 or 1999 when I went to Hawaii, and we made it to the tournament. So they sent down TV crews and stuff here to Newfoundland, and when those people came back and they saw where I came from and they realized the tragedy of my parents and everything that happened. I was approached then, and I just wasn't ready. No part of me was ready to do it then, because when you're five and you lose your parents, your whole world is turned upside down, but you're still only five. But then when you're 10 and you're 15, then it really affects you, because now you're struggling and you're questioning why this is happening. You're questioning why you're alone. You're questioning, you know, why is this happening to me? And there was times I even questioned, why not me? So it was a dark time, and I looked to basketball, and basketball was kind of like my sanctuary that just helped me get out and helped me be free. And that's most of what I can remember at that age.
Well, it's pretty amazing. You know, you talk about, you know, maybe not getting lost, but just really immersing yourself in basketball. What were the, why basketball? Like, it doesn't seem like a traditional sport at that time in Canada.
Yeah, no, not in Newfoundland. Newfoundland is a very proud tradition for hockey as well. And
sure.
I just left a hockey tournament now for 4 days with my son. So, yeah, it's very unique. I think I just loved it. I don't know. I got introduced to it in gym at an early age, and I had a little bit of success for it, but it was just something that just drove me. And I mean, hockey at the time as well, it's very expensive to play hockey. I loved hockey and was, you know, I'm tooting my own horn, but I was a pretty good hockey player. But like, you know, we just played a lot of pond hockey and on the ice growing up that way, not so much, you know, the way my kids are at it. But basketball for me was that outlet. And then I got better, and I think I had a little bit of failure, but then I just loved it. And even now when I teach and try to teach kids, I just try to teach them whatever they're doing, just to love what they're doing, because then once you get punched in the face or you get knocked down, if you really love something, you have no problem getting back up and keep fighting at it. So basketball was that for me. And, you know, I had a pretty good time doing it along the way.
Oh, yeah, I would think so. Now, looking back at your career, You had something like close to 50 different schools offering you scholarships for their programs. Out of 50, why did you decide on the University of Hawaii?
Well, I'll tell you a little bit about that. I mean, when I left Newfoundland when I was in grade to go to grade 12, and that was kind of unheard of. I was pretty much dominating here, 50, 60 points a game, and I couldn't get a look. You gotta imagine now, I'm assuming you guys are my age or probably older, but you know, there was no internet, there was no smartphones,
sure.
there was no ways to find people. So there was actually a flyer that came in my mail, and it was a team in Ontario that this guy, Andre Sola, went and got a scholarship from St. Thomas Aquinas. So I was like, I'm going there. So I fished all that summer to raise money to go up to Ontario to go to this school with the dream of getting the scholarship. So when I get up there, the teachers are on strike. And I'm thinking, well, what the frick am I doing here? You know, I didn't come up here for the education. So, you know, I had a buddy there that had got to school cassette video recorder, and he videotaped me doing a bunch of dunks and highlights and dribbles. And then at the end of it, I put on a grade 11 game from back home at Fatima, And I went to, it's a fancy school. Like, I'm coming from a school that has 200 people. This school had 2,000 people, and they had, like, a video recording room. So I went and I bought about, like, 100-something tapes at Staples. And I went in, and whatever way they had their video recording room, you could do 8, 10 at a time. Or I think it was 6. And I just went for weeks, and I just record this video. So the guidance counselor then gave me the address of the schools, and I sent all these highlight tape is what we called it, and I put my resume in there.
Yeah.
But needless to say, my resume was pretty bleak. I think I had on like 6'4", I was 165 pounds, and I had some accolades from Newfoundland, but I really had nothing on my resume, right? So just sent this off, and sure enough, NCA schools were replying back. I'm like, oh, we want to see you play, and we're interested in you. And I started getting letters and things, but they couldn't come see me play because the teachers went on strike. So then I got tangled up in some AAU basketball at the time and went all through. And then I went down to Atlantic Cape camps, which, you know, the guy that coached took down 7 or 8 guys in the van. We just hopped in the van and went down to New Jersey. But this was the time when ABC and the Nike camps and stuff were around. And they left there, so I was MVP of the thing and of the camp. And then we were playing the All-Star game. And everybody left, must have been 100 scouts all came over and watched me play. And I got MVP of that camp, and then I had a bunch of interest then. So when I chose Hawaii, I remember telling my family, I was like, man, I'm going to Hawaii just because I'll never have a chance to go there again. You know, I was like, this is why not take a free visit? Because Syracuse were putting me in a prep school, right? So I was my intentions were I was going to a prep school in Pennsylvania because I had another year of eligibility in high school ranks, and then I'd have more time to play and get noticed. But I went down to Hawaii on a visit, and pretty much the rest is history. I signed when I was there.
Carl English joins us, of course, a former professional basketball player, still playing, actually, for Canada. He has a book out, Chasing a Dream, The Carl English Story. It's available on Kindle, and I know that coming in the new year, hoping to have it available at Chapters and Costco and other stores. You know, the story is really just about determination, and can you talk a little bit about, you know, losing your parents, both your mom and dad, in a house fire that you were only 5 years of age? You had 4 brothers, all 5 brothers got out. I'm assuming that you're pretty close because of that tragedy at such a young age for your brothers. And were they into basketball the same as you?
Yeah, I mean, at 5, when you lose your mom and dad and something like this, I mean, it just rocks your world. But then to make it worse, I mean, we all got separated. So 3 brothers went to live with an aunt and uncle. I went to live with my mom's sister. And another brother, Bradley, went to live with my another one of my mom's sisters. So, we went to the same school, 3 or 4 of us. My second oldest brother went to town, which is a couple hours away. But we ended up playing ball and stuff against each other. And, I mean, we're very close now. But, I mean, growing up, it was one thing to have your world turned upside down, but then you're taken away from your family as well. So, you know, it's, you know, that saying that people say, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I guess that's true to some extent, but that was pretty difficult. And I think that was the biggest reason why I put off the book for 20 years is because, you know, I had to face that head on, you know, and when Blake came down and we got together and we did almost 50 hours of recordings in 7-8 days. And I remember going to bed, and I was just physically and emotionally drained as if I played 5 basketball games. And I think it was because I finally let myself tell how I really felt and what those things, whether it was the tragedy. And then I lost, I don't know if you guys read the book yet, but I lost my uncle when I was 20, when I came back from Hawaii, and he raised me, my like my dad.
Yeah.
And he dropped dead in front of me when we were coming from fishing. So, you know, I really went into depth on how this made me feel, and then cutting and not making the NBA and the money I lost and injuries and different things. But when I was facing it now, when I wrote the story, it was like, Jesus, all this stuff really happened. And it was like, because I used to bury it, like, pardon the pun, but I buried it so deep, and then I just go on to the next thing. Like, I'm going to prove everybody wrong, and I'm going to fight harder, and I'm going to, you know, it's obviously a story of tragedy, but it's a story of determination. It's a story of perseverance and hard work and, you know, the things you can achieve when you put your mind to. So is that just a basketball story? It's a life story. And it's, I mean, the first month we've done over 10,000 copies and we're just here locally. So, you know, we're talking to chapters in Costco when it's supposed to go right across the country. So hopefully they can get their stuff together faster and get it out there. So, you know, it's been well received.
Well, it's a great story, Carl. And, you know, you've definitely had some tragedy and some obstacles overcome. But, you know, after university, you go on to have, you know, we're still playing a pretty lengthy pro career. What kept driving you through all those years, different leagues, different teams, and a lot of success you had?
The biggest thing that drove me for so long was just my goal of trying to make the NBA. That was the name. Those two titles we played around with, the one was Chasing a Dream, which we end up choosing. The other one was Did I Make It? Because everybody perceives whether you make the pros and the high level and how they perceive success, I would say. And everybody's success is different. And, you know, getting a scholarship and, you know, and getting a great job is successful for some people. But what haunted me for so long and what pushed me so hard was just my drive to try to get back to the NBA, because I had a taste of it with the Pacers. I signed a 2-year partial guaranteed contract, but that was the most money I've ever seen. And, you know, and then you fight and you try to get back. And then there was the roller coaster to D-League. I got called to go to Orlando. And then when I get to the airport, the big guy goes down in camp and, you know, they say, we're still going to watch you. So that was a roller coaster. And then the European circuit, I mean, was amazing because, you know, I've got to go all around the world. I played in Spain for over 10 years, which is the best league outside the NBA. And, I mean, I dominated these circuits and you're like a rock star in these cities. And, you know, you have a very high quality of life because, you know, they're pro basketball and soccer in these countries is, you know, is par none. And it's probably more successful in a sense from fan base than, you know, NBA teams and stuff. And you go through this roller coaster, I call it, of up and downs and trying to get to the top and, you know, getting cut or getting injured or just fighting to stay on the top then. And the top for me was these teams in Europe. And, you know, fortunately, I've got to play in some great countries and, you know, I've set some amazing records and won championships and scoring leaders. And, you know, I've been blessed in so many ways and have a beautiful family and all that's true, you know, true playing of basketball. I'm from a town of 20 people, right? And when you said why wasn't I playing hockey? Well, when I look at when those camera crews came down from CBS and they came back, the producer looked at me when he came to the game and when we played Syracuse, he's like, how the hell did you get out of where you came from? You know what I mean? And it's really truly a blessing and it's really truly just a sign of just hard work and dedication and just believing in yourself, because along that road, I mean, so many people doubt you and so many people question. And then, I mean, I've had almost 10 surgeries in my career, and to still be playing or still play, to play the length of time and at the level that I played for so long, you know, it's just a testimony of who I am as a person. And I guess just my mindset of believing in myself.
You mentioned earlier before the break how, you know, one of their titles was Did I Make It? Did you ever get to a point where you were like, you know what, I did make it? Like, playing the NBA is obviously great, but playing pro sports for that long is a really good achievement. Did you ever find that, I don't know, peace with that and acceptance with it?
I mean, yes and no. I think it just defined me for so long, and that was the battle. And even when I was strong with the title, did I make it? Because there was a point where I made what my biggest regret was is when there's a couple. I came out as a junior. I graduated as a junior with my sports management degree, and then I had my senior year left. I could have went back to school. Obviously, that was a mistake. But you can't hang your hat on that, and you got to keep fighting and figure it out. But then when I finally got my groove and was dominating in Europe, what really haunts me, I want to say, is then I should have came back and took a really serious, hard try at the NBA, because I was a lot better. I was stronger. You know, I was more fit. I was kind of like in my prime, we'd say. The issue was, and this is how I try to describe it to people, when June hits June, July hits in Spain or in Europe, I'm like a Kobe Bryant, so say, in the sense of I'm a prime candidate for the best jobs in Europe, which obviously pay the most money. For the NBA at that point in my career, they weren't looking at a guy like me. They would look at a guy like me in September, let's say.
Yeah.
Right? So when you look at a guy like in September, October, go to training camp, have a good look, chances of making team, probably get a partially guaranteed of 50 or 100 grand to go there. Well, at that point, I would have been losing money because I would have took a pay cut to go to the NBA at that point in my career, which I was fine with. What I wasn't fine with was if I got cut in November, well, I'm also 3 months behind in Europe. A lot of the good jobs, if all the good jobs they're taking, now I got to kind of find a niche, and I could end up in a crazy country for me and my family. So these are the things that were playing on my head, and I always, once I got to a certain point, I stuck with that league, I stuck with that level, I stuck with that security for me and my family, right? So that was something that really haunts me in the sense of I wish I had to go back and try it and really give it a fair shot, because then I think I could have had peace with it. So, yeah, it still haunts me. I mean, when I reflect back, and I only can go by what people say, because, you know, everybody thinks, oh, my career was good or my career wasn't. It's kind of your own impression, but I can only go by what analysts and people say, and they've described one of my career as one of the best ever of any Canadian, including NBA people. So, you know, obviously you got your Steve and Jamal, and then, you know, you got your, a lot of young up-and-comers. So, you know, it's something up for debate, I would say.
Carl, you know, you touched on the fact that you started to dominate in Europe. Was it, you know, you also mentioned at one point you were 6'4", 165 pounds, which must have left a little bit of room in the old jersey as you were shooting hoops. But what was it, just the physical part that got you to that level in Europe, or what else was it?
No, well, when I first went to Hawaii, I gained 20 pounds in that first year and a half. So it wasn't so much that. I think it was more finding yourself, finding your game, getting confident in your skills, understanding what you do good at. Obviously, I played point guard in college, but I'm more of a scorer and a shooting guard. And then it was more, you know, I'm always a combo guard. So, and in Europe, I'm big, like I'm 6'5", 205. So I always rebounded the ball well. I think when I start having success, to be honest, and this is the advice I give the young Canadians when I talk to Kevin Pangos and these guys, I was like, embrace yourself with the culture and the people and where you are and have peace with that and quit trying to chase whatever else it is. Focus on the moment. And I think when I started embracing the culture and understanding the people around me and appreciating those things, that's when I think my game started to flourish, because obviously I'm more comfortable and I'm at peace. I felt when I was always trying to chase for the next thing, next team, next, well, you're probably playing anxious, or you're probably trying to do too much stuff that you shouldn't be. So I think that's when I started to have success. And then also you start to get more mature. And when you get mature, you see NBA players all the time, or even college players. They're different as they age and they mature and they understand what they're dealing with. And then there's the confidence. I've always never lacked confidence in myself. And, you know, I'll give you one story. I got off a plane. I went home for, I had a contract buyout in Greece, and I went home for 2-3 weeks because I wanted to go home for to see my family, because I went over on a two-month gig. And I took 2 weeks off and went home to see my family, and we played on the 27th. So I had to fly back on the 26th, and they were all trying to get me to leave on Christmas Day. And I'm like, no, I'm not leaving my family. I was like, I'm coming back, and they were coming back a month later. So I got off the plane the morning of the 27th, or like midday, had a couple hours nap, and then I went to the game and dropped 30. And the coach was like, I've never had a player. And I was like, well, I'm not your normal player. And I was like, I don't lack confidence, and my shot ain't changed. And it don't matter who I'm playing against, I'm going to find a way to get it done. So it's kind of like I've always had that confidence in myself, and that's what I kind of instill in young people. You know, I always tell them to believe in yourself, because if you don't, nobody else will. You know, if that makes sense.
Oh, it totally makes sense. Carl English joins us, a professional basketball player, now author. Of course, Blake Murphy was helping you write that. There was forward was done by Steve Nash. And Carl, as a Canadian, you look just how the game, you know, you were a shooter, and the NBA game has changed a lot, right? Guys like you, we have Steve Sir here, who still holds the NCAA 3-point percentage shooting record, and he's kind of always said if he came out of the NCAA now, he'd be on a team just because the game has changed so much for shooting. And, you know, your career would similar be that way. But you just look at the Canadian guys coming out now. How much more enjoyment do you have, you know, when you see, because it's not just one player. Like, you know, there's 10 or 12, like, legit players in the NBA now that are Canadian.
It's amazing. I mean, I had the pleasure, I think, in 2015, I played, we did the Pan Am Games, and there was a lot of those guys were there in camp with, I mean, Wiggins was there. Corey's been there for a few years. I worked 3, 4, 5 years with Kelly and, you know, Dwight Powell and Tristan. And you're just looking at them and you're just in awe in the fact of, wow, these young kids now, and the pipeline is there and the pipeline is strong. And I think it all comes into fruition in the sense of, like I told you, me and Steve Kerr in that era, it was a lot harder to get noticed. It was a lot harder to be scouted. Like, you can't hide. Nobody can hide no more. Even if you're trying to hide, you can't hide. With the social media, the internet, like, it's made the world so much smaller. And just to touch on the game itself, I mean, I always tell myself I'm 20 years too early. I mean, the game now is up and down and launching three-pointers. And, you know, there was years, like, I look at percentages, and, I mean, one year, the year I led the ACC in scoring, I think I shot 46, 47% from three. So, you know, it's those type of shooters and those type of things. Now you're definitely finding a spot on an NBA team. And also the fact that they have these two ways. Like, the pass is so much different now, and I think we're seeing that, and we're taking advantage of that. And there's a lot of guys now that can go to the D-League and stay home and make a couple $100,000 and chase that dream. Whereas before, when I was in the D-League, there was only six teams, and you were only making $24,000 a year. So, I mean, when a team comes and they offer you $25,000 a month and it's clean, as a rookie, you're like, oh, I think I might cross the water. You know what I mean? So. It's not a hard decision, right? And then when you get, you know, you can make $50,000-$100,000 a month in Europe easily when you're solidified and you have that resume behind you. So it's something. There's a lot of options now, but I think social media and the internet has made the world so much smaller.
Carl, your time spent abroad. What was your favorite place to play, and the team, and why?
Favorite place for me has always been Barcelona. I mean, we lived in Port de Olímpico, where they had the Olympics village. Jeez. And I was right overlooking the beach right there, and beautiful, beautiful city. I mean, as a foreigner, there, Madrid were probably my two best. And then, you know what's crazy too? I love Athens. I lived in Athens in Greece. I'm in a very chaotic city, but I love that. Again, I don't know if you read, I have some stories in there about Greek fans. If you remember that there, I mean, I don't know if I put into one when they peed on, or they tried to pee in a bottle and throw it at me. So we were on the road and I was leading that league in scoring. So your home fans couldn't travel with you. So it was only, when you went on the road, it was only the home fans. Like, your away fans couldn't come. So our fans came, and they stormed the gym. And there was like 200-300 of them. And the cops came out with all the riot gear, and they threw the tear gas. And I'm thinking, like, where am I? What's going on? So we're warming up, and our eyes start burning. Then they take us out back, and we're out getting fresh air. And about 40 minutes later, we continue on to the game. So I get in the game, and I start getting going and get talking some noise. So the place is getting rowdy, and all of a sudden I seen this thing fly by my head, and I ducked, and it was all yellow. So the guy was after taking a leak in a bottle and throwing it at me. So our security run out, and they cover me, and they're like, English, no talk. This place crazy, crazy, no talk, no talk. So You know, so everywhere we go, like, they'd warn me then from then on the rest of the season. They would tell me where I was allowed and what I could do because the security was so tough. And I always, like, I feed off that kind of stuff. I fed off the fire of the crowd, and I fed off these things my whole career. So it was, you know, it was a very chaotic country, but I loved it. So I've been fortunate. I mean, I lived in Zadar in Croatia. I was right on, I had a nice little villa right on the Adriatic Sea. I was in Gran Canaria for 2 years, right on the ocean there in Canary Islands. I was in northern Spain, which is similar, you know, right up in the tip of France almost. I was down in Sevilla, which is down in southern Spain. I was in Madrid, Malaga, Valencia. Like, so I've been all over. It's been blessed. And then towards the end, I went to Alba Berlin in Germany, which is another beautiful place to play. I played in Puerto Rico, and then, you know, come back home and finish my last 2 years in our beautiful province of Newfoundland. So,
well, Carl, your story, your basketball career has definitely come full circle. I highly recommend for people the basketball story stuff is great, but just your outlook on life, you know, just an unimaginable tragedy as a young 5 year old with your four brothers to lose your parents in a house fire and then, you know, have to live apart. And then thankfully you guys are back and close together now as your adults and as a father. I'm sure you more than most can relate to the importance of being around your kids. So great story. Enjoy, keep playing, and enjoy watching Canadian basketball stars. The Next Generation looks great, and I highly recommend people getting the book. Any idea on when it might be available in stores?
We're going to keep pushing it. I think they have some meetings here now in the first week of the new year. I think Indigo will take it and put X number all across. And then I know we're talking to head office in Costco because I think we went through over 4,000 there in like less than 10 days. So, I mean, that should testify itself. But, you know, I think right now it's on Amazon and Kindle. You can get it on iBooks. And, you know, I know Chapters do deliver as well. You can buy it online. But my goal is right now I want to get it right across the country. And then I kind of want to do a little tour and promote it and, you know, do some things with some kids and different youth right across the country. And then the next step, we've been approached on some different things, and hopefully don't want to let the cat out of the bag, but it'd be nice to look at a documentary or movie rights or something like that. So there's a few things in the works, but, you know, I'm just humbled. I mean, I've always been hungry and humbled my whole life. I think what the big part for me with the story was is right across the country is, and you guys said it, you could look at someone like me and with a bit of hard work and dedication, you can surpass and be better than me. It's not easy to, it's great to have LeBron James as a role model, but not everybody's born 6'8", 265, right? But, you know, I'm someone, you know, when you look at a Steve Nash, he's extremely gifted, but he also worked his butt off his whole life. When you look at people that are similar to yourself and similar to different paths in rural Canada cities all across the country, there's so many people out there, but I'm hopefully these kids can look at me, and if they're dealing with anything in their life, they can understand that they're not alone, and that, you know, a sport, whatever that sport may be, they can strive for greatness if they continue to believe in themselves and work hard.
Well, Carl, awesome story. I will look forward to it, and we'll make a deal that when you do your cross-country tour, you stop in Edmonton, you come back and join us in studio.
Awesome, guys. Thanks so much for having me. It seems like a great show.